Today's sponsor is Audible.com, which has more than 180,000 audiobooks and spoken word audio products. We have a special offer for undisclosed listeners. You can get a free 30-day trial at www.audible.com/undisclosed. Again, that's www.audible.com/undisclosed. This week's episode is also brought to you by Stamps.com. Mailing and shipping can seem like a no-win situation because the post office takes way too much time and a postage meter is way too expensive. Fortunately, there's a better way. Stamps.com. With Stamps.com, you can buy and print official U.S. postage for any letter or package using your own computer and printer. You never have to leave the house. Right now, sign up for Stamps.com and use my promo code, undisclosed, for this special offer. You get a 4-week trial and $110 in a bonus offer, including postage and a digital scale. Don't wait. Go to Stamps.com before you do anything else. Click on the microphone at the top of the homepage and type in undisclosed. That's Stamps.com and enter undisclosed. Hi and welcome to a special series of undisclosed episodes post-conviction relief. Today we have part one. My name is Rabia Chaudhry. I'm an attorney and a soon-to-be senior fellow at the U.S. Institute of Peace, and I'm joined with my colleagues Susan Simpson and Colin Miller. Susan is an associate at the Volcal Law Group in Washington, D.C., and she blogs at theviewfromll2.com. And Colin is an associate dean and evidence professor at the University of South Carolina School of Law, and he's also the blog editor of the Evidence Prof blog. Now, as many of you know, a couple of weeks ago, the Baltimore City Circuit Court held a hearing in Adnan's reopened post-conviction relief appeal. And it began on February 3rd and lasted until the following week, February 9th. The hearings included opening and closing arguments and the testimony of witnesses from both parties. Presiding was Judge Martin Welch, who was the same judge who actually denied the PCR 2 years ago. And present in the courtroom were Adnan, his family, many community friends, Susan, Bob Ruff, many supporters, Hayes community, an entire section of media. It was quite an exciting and yet stressful 5 days, even though I spent almost no time in the courtroom, and you'll find out soon enough why. But the night before the hearing began, we organized an open community briefing and prayer meeting at a local mosque. Actually, it was at Adnan's Mosque, the Islamic Society of Baltimore, which is just down the street from his house. But as if things couldn't get crazier, the same day the hearings were going to begin, the President of the United States, Barack Obama, decided, for the first time in his presidency ever, to visit a mosque. And he decided to visit Adnan's mosque. So because of all the security protocols, we had to move our gathering to another mosque, which wasn't far away, but it did make for an interesting last-minute scramble. Now, a few days before all of this happened, I got a text from Bob Ruff, who is the host of the Truth and Justice podcast, as many of you know, and he made a sudden decision to come and attend the hearing. He wasn't planning on it, but then he had a dream in which he saw all of us sitting together welcoming a newly freed Adnan. And when he woke up, he felt like he just had to be here. And so he did come, and he arrived just in time for the event to begin at the mosque. There were a few hundred people, Adnan's brothers and mother, Saad, many other friends, and we were really honored that Bob joined us and also that Michael Wood joined us, and both of them said a few words of encouragement. Suffice it to say that the next morning we were really full of hope and expectation as we gathered at Justin Brown's office and together we walked to the courthouse, having waited all these years for Adnan to finally get a fair shake in court. At 9 a.m., we were seated and ready to go. About 3 years ago, in the first post-conviction hearing, that was the first time I saw Justin in court. And Justin has always been just brilliant, measured, smart. But, you know, I'm a little more of an aggressive, assertive person, and he's very, very calm. And so, you know, I expected to see that Justin again this time around. And I got to see him only in the opening remarks at the beginning of the day, after which I didn't get to see anything until the closing arguments. And within the first few minutes, I was like, who is this person? Because this was not, I mean, he, even just in the first couple of minutes of the opening arguments, he was so much more assertive and just pointed and just really, really, you could like sense kind of this, I don't know what it was, not an aggression, but kind of a seriousness, a real passion that, to be honest, I had worried about a little bit because I thought, you know, I know how aggressive the prosecution's always been. And I worried about the fact that Justin is not as assertive. You know, he's just very kind of calm.
That was not a problem this time around.
Not a problem this time around is what I've heard. So I was like blown away when he began, and I thought his opening was really tight. Susan can talk about the substance of it, but you know, he basically just said, this is what we're going to show you. These are the points. We're going to prove these points, and these are the issues. It was very, you know, just narrow. Like, these are the issues we're going to look at, and these are the only issues that matter.
Yeah, his opening was just a good, clean opening. It wasn't flowery or dramatic. It was just very straightforward. Your Honor, here's what we're going to show. Here's why it's important. Here's what the law is, and here's what it says is applied to these facts. Very straightforward, and exactly what he needed, really. I mean, he just laid out. In my notes, I have, it's only 1.5 pages. It's pretty short, and he just said, two issues here. We've got Asia McClain. There's a failure to investigate and failure to contact her, and a brief recital of facts. And I think the most interesting thing he said in his opening was he said, we met a few weeks ago in chambers, and Your Honor, you told us that what you wanted to know was why Gutierrez never contacted Asia. And Justin told him, well, we'll show you why. And it's because although she had been a great lawyer in her prime, by 95, a decline started. And by the time of Adnan's trials, she was no longer the attorney she had been. As he put it, as a result of the wheels coming off the bus and human error, that is why she never contacted Asia McClain. There's no bigger story here. It was just a ball that was dropped. But I thought that was interesting, too, to find out that the judge has told the parties he wanted to know why Asia was never contacted. So that kind of frames what the Asia issue is going to be like going in. For the cell site stuff, he, again, very short, he said, at first this may seem like a technical or complicated issue, but it's not. And basically, here's what the document said. Here's what didn't happen. Here's what would have happened if Gutierrez or Oronowitz had actually seen the document, and here's why it matters now. He also pointed out that, in fact, they were raising two issues. The defense was raising two issues at court. The first was that Gutierrez was ineffective for failing to raise this, but he was raising in the alternative a Brady claim, because what happened with the Exhibit 31, which is the cell phone records, and with the facts cover sheet, is that that was never properly disclosed to the defense. And in Justin's words, they committed a Brady violation of epic proportions. He said either issue alone is enough for a new trial. Both severely undermined Adnan's right to a fair trial. And like he told the court, we are not here to retry the case. We're here to present facts.
At this point, just to set the stage, Adnan had not yet entered the courtroom. I hadn't seen him yet. None of us had. I think Justin's opening was maybe 15 minutes, 20 minutes. Is that about right? Does that sound right,
Susan?
If that, right. It wasn't that long. Then what happened was, and I actually noticed this, I was sitting in the very first row with Adnan's family and Saad, and Susan was next to me and Bob was right behind us, that I noticed we were sitting right behind actually the prosecutor's side of the room, I guess. And he turned around and he looked right at me and made eye contact. And then he said to the judge that actually we have a preliminary matter we have to take care of. And that was the sequestration. So a lot of people are very confused about why I was sequestered or what this was about. So it's important to talk about that a bit, because after that, I was out of the courtroom.
So there's a rule, it's Federal Rule 615 in Maryland. It is Maryland Rule of Evidence 5-615, which says basically parties can ask for witnesses to be sequestered. The point being, if you have two witnesses and they're covering the same factual ground, there's a concern that a later witness would hear what an earlier witness said and try to coordinate their testimony. And so I guess the ground here was they claimed Asia's testifying, she had an interaction with Rabia, and therefore having Rabia in the courtroom could lead to that coordination. But a few things. There's a Maryland case, Court of Appeals of Maryland, the Tharp case, which says if the prosecution is going to do that, and this is a person who's been removed from the witness list, which is the case for Rabia, they have to give reasons why they would call this witness, and the judge on the record should explain why this witness is being sequestered. And that was never done. What I find most interesting is, at least, and Susan, you probably can speak to this more being in the courtroom, it's my understanding that when that first witness, Irwin, was testifying, that the state was making objection after objection, saying, you're covering the same grounds covered at the initial PCR hearing. Okay, well, that's fine. They can do that, and the judge sustained that, but Robbie already testified. And so what was the state's argument that were making all these objections to Irwin that we could recall Rabia and have her go over basically what she already testified to several years ago.
Yeah, they weren't going to call her again. I mean, everything she had to say that was relevant, she had already said. I mean, it is what it is.
It is what it is. So what I did was I ducked out. I spent some time in the hallway outside fuming for a bit. Then I got it together and I went across the street to a Dunkin' Donuts. And that became kind of our headquarters where we would break and meet and do some media, do some recording for like the next 4 or 5 days. We did immediately call Colin and say, help us out here. Find us some case law. We can head off to Justin because, you know, Justin had a lot on his plate and that was like the last thing. I mean, low priority, really, because my being in the courtroom wasn't going to make an impact one way or the other on what was actually happening in front of the judge. But obviously, I did want to be there. And I thought that was just the prosecutor. You know, this is a little bit of a power play, and they know that I've been a little bit vocal, just a little bit vocal about the prosecutor himself personally, too. So, you know, slow clap. Good job, Thiru.
I think it's important to note, though, too, this is not just about you. It's the right that is being enforced. It's the defendant. It's Adnan's right to a public trial under the Sixth Amendment. And the point is, if you weren't going to be called, you were a member of the public, and he had a right to members of the public being there to see and report on the proceedings. That's the whole point of the right to a public trial, is we have some transparency. So it's not just a matter of you wanted to be there. It was Adnan's right as much as your right to have you in the courtroom.
Yeah, I agree. And, you know, a little bit of background. What happened was Justin had originally put me on the witness list. And so a few weeks before this happened, he said, listen, I have some bad news. You're on the witness list, so you might be sequestered. So then I had a discussion with him and Adnan because I personally didn't quite understand. I said, if the issue he is basically whether or not, you know, Asia has the right date and she was not contacted. Like, I really can't speak to those things at all. I mean, I came in after the fact. And so at some point, Adnan said to Justin, listen, it's much more important for me to have and my family to have her in the room than for her to provide any kind of testimony. Like, and so I don't want her on the witness list. So it was important to him. He was a little bit perturbed, but, you know, we got over it.
Yeah, Justin told me when, because he did, this issue did get raised later on, and he said, when I talked to him about it, and like, well, Colin's looking into it, we'll see if there's case law, he was like, well, Adnan wants her to be there. It's important to him to have her there. So if possible, we'd like her back in the courtroom.
Well, I wasn't, so.
Which means, though, I should point out, I am the only member of Team Undisclosed who was there in the courtroom. So we are relying on my notes for details about what happened in the courtroom that didn't get reported already. And I tried my best to be as thorough and diligent as possible, but I am sure there are times when I either wrote things down wrong or probably even more likely, I misinterpreted my own notes, my own chicken scratch, trying to put my 80-page typed up notes together. So I'll try and be as accurate as possible, but I apologize in advance if I happen to write something down wrong during the course of the hearing.
And this is a good place, actually, to just explain to people, because we have gotten this question over and over about whether or not it was videotaped and when the transcripts are going to be available and all those things. The court does have an internal video recording system, and it was recorded. That video footage is only available to, I believe, the attorneys, both parties, and they cannot disperse it like publicly. So even though Adnan's attorney can get a hold of it, he cannot pass it along to the public. The transcripts, I believe, are going to be available after the judge renders his ruling. I don't know, though, to be honest, if the video is ever going to be available or if at that point maybe audio will. So, yeah, right now we're working with Susan's notes, but judging from her notebook, every time she popped out, she did a lot of writing, so I'm sure we'll be fine.
You know, Theo's opening was good, but I will say he talks like he writes.
Definitely, yeah.
Those very elaborate turns of phrases he likes to use. It's not just his writing voice.
I noticed that in his closing. So let's talk a little bit about the state's opening arguments then. What was your impression, Susan?
It was not a bad opening. I had two things that did bother me about it, but other than that, I thought it was solid. So to read some of what I wrote down, he started off with saying, in light of all that's happened, it is easy to forget the tragedy that brought us here in the first place. The defendant was convicted by overwhelming evidence that he strangled the victim with his bare hands and buried her in a shallow grave with another witness. Mr. Syed has had able counsel at all times, but the question before the court is not the overwhelming evidence. It is the narrow question of whether the defendant had ineffective assistance, which would have been good if he'd abided by his own starting conditions. Because despite saying the question before the court is not the overwhelming evidence, and it's only these two issues, the issues that are actually before the court on the PCR hearing, Theroux took every chance he possibly got to use the phrase overwhelming evidence. He's guilty. He did it. Which, when you tell the court you're not going to address something and you then address it 12 times, that's probably a deduction for style points.
Yeah, so I'm looking through Susan's notes about Theroux's opening about Asia. Seems like he was telling Judge Welsh that pursuit of Asia was not a worthwhile endeavor, that overall she took the alibi defense very seriously, that there were reasons to think that Asia wasn't reliable and might have been risky if called as a witness. And basically, I guess summing up everything that he was saying, his conclusion and his argument to Judge Welch is that Gutierrez was aware of Asia and she made a tactical decision that pursuing her was not necessary because her potential to cause harm outweighed the potential for her to be helpful in any way to Adnan's case.
He also argued that Asia's testimony now could not, as a matter of law, influence the court's decision about what Gutierrez should have done then, because the test is about what should have been done in 99, 2000, not based on how capable of a witness Asia is at this point in time, which came up a lot later on in the proceedings.
I find that a really odd argument. I mean, in any situation like this, all a judge is going to have in front of him is, especially if the testimony is consistent with what we know that this witness apparently was going to be saying at the time of the original proceedings. I just find this an odd argument. I mean, is this a legally sound argument, Colin?
For deficient performance, it makes sense because, again, the attorney can only take action based on what she knew or reasonably should have known at the time. So to a certain extent, yes. But there's also the question of materiality, which Asia's testimony now was very much relevant concerning.
I can't find the citation now, but I know Justin cited it in one of his briefs. There is case law out there that says a witness's testimony at a PCR proceeding is relevant to both prongs of the Strickland ineffective assistance of counsel test. So there certainly is case law out there that says it's not just important for prejudice, but also seeing that witness on the stand, seeing how credible they are, does have bearing upon both prongs of ineffective assistance. And therefore, Judge Welch hopefully will take that into account.
Yeah, and then for the cell phone evidence, which was also addressed, the state prosecutor, Theroux, complained that Justin Brown's position had shifted. He brought up the fact that Justin had the document since 2010 from his MPIA request, which he did, and hadn't brought it up sooner. So according to him, it was no longer a valid issue. Theroux said that he found it to be somewhat incredible to suggest that there could have been a Brady issue because there was, in fact, open file discovery or an open file policy at the time, which means that all the evidence did go to Gutierrez, and of course there couldn't have been Brady because it was open file. So although Theroux acknowledged that he respected Justin's attempt to use Brady as a vehicle to raise the cell evidence, the court should not be second-guessing trial strategy. And again, he was convicted on the basis of overwhelming evidence. What he also did is mention over and over again how effective Gutierrez was, how great she was. I mean, I think he said the great work Gutierrez and her team did, talked about how diligent she was, how she was so strategic, and how she was so tactical, and she took the alibi very seriously. And she was just a great, great trial attorney and kept harping on how wonderful she was and how she was such a big name back in Maryland in the time for, you know, defense work. And that, of course, she had a reason for not contacting Asia because she was just so great. We'll discuss that more later. But it comes up again because despite Theroux repeating at every opportunity, not only was Adnan convicted by overwhelming evidence, but his attorney was great and diligent, Theroux objected strenuously to any attempt ever to mention the fact that Gutierrez had in fact been declining, or been in decline for quite a while already, at the time of Adnan's trial. So basically, he wanted leeway to say how great Gutierrez was, but to prohibit the defense from ever referencing any kind of failure of any sort on her part. And he closed his opening with, despite the great work Gutierrez and her team did, the defendant was convicted for two reasons. First, because there was overwhelming evidence that swamped and dwarfed the vigorous defense Gutierrez put forth. And second, because he did it. Nothing Gutierrez could have done could have changed that outcome because he was guilty. Which, again, has nothing to do with the PCR, really, because we just have the alibi issue and the cell phone issue. So it does address materiality. But to claim that throwing out the cell phone evidence and introducing an alibi could not have made a difference, it's a bold claim.
So the very first witness called then to the stand is a man named Phil Dantes. Dantes was called by Justin. And, you know, the way this works is that Adnan will present his case first. So he'll present his witnesses first generally, and then the, you know, the state will cross-examine them and the state will present their witnesses and Justin cross-examines them. It did get a little bit out of order, but anyhow, we began with Justin's first witness, who was Phil Dantes. Now, Phil Dante was somebody who knew Christina Gutierrez and he worked with her. He actually represented her when there was an initial attempt to get her disbarred later. He represented her to get her barred too?
He did both times. Yeah, he represented her at the start and the end of her career. So okay. He was in the best position of just about anyone to speak to her abilities and her decline. And he was also very close with her as a friend. So he knew her very well.
Now, I was getting bits and pieces from like Twitter, as people would, like every media would every so often step out and tweet things out. But apparently there's one witness who said they didn't want to be there, but they were there because they were subpoenaed. And was this that witness?
That was the next one. And I will say it was a very interesting experience from, you know, ducking in and out of the court. I had my phone probably like 5 minutes total during the day, so I could briefly occasionally look at Twitter or something and you'd see all these reports about what just happened in the courtroom. And you're like, no, that's kind of the opposite of what just happened. And not always in ways that matter, but just factually incorrect things that had gotten turned around in the game of telephone. So it was kind of funny to see how things were getting reported, mostly via Twitter because it was all kind of live, versus the reality of what went on.
Are you talking about like actual reporters or just like spectators in the court, like people from the public?
You know, I don't even know.
You don't even know. Yeah, it was
sometimes. Occasionally you'd see reporters. And again, I'm not even talking about things that like matter in terms of like who won or who lost. Just weird factual details that gotten transformed already in the space between the court and Twitter.
Well, Phil Dante was called by Justin for one reason, really to testify about what Gutierrez's career was like, what her decline was like, what his experience with her was like, and what she was experiencing by the time she started representing Adnan.
And it's worth pointing out that even before Dante got on the stand, Theroux objected to him and said that it's not appropriate to have him testify. It has nothing to do with the issue before the court. He gave two reasons. The first is that, again, whether Gutierrez was having personal or financial issues doesn't matter. And this was already brought up before. It's already before the court, and we shouldn't hear it again. His evidence for it being before the court is to point out that during the previous PCR hearing in 2012, Justin called Yerk to the stand and asked if he'd known that Gutierrez had been disbarred. Yerk responded that he did not. Later on in closing, Justin brought it up again, mentioned either her being disbarred or something about her rapid decline. Murphy objected. The objection was sustained. And according to Theroux, because Gutierrez's decline and disbarment was alluded to directly in the previous hearing, it is not a proper subject matter before the court now. So again, even though he'd just given his opening in which he'd mentioned how fantastic of an attorney Gutierrez was, probably six times, he was now arguing for the court that any evidence of Gutierrez not being fantastic couldn't come in.
Wouldn't this be directly, like this testimony would directly answer the judge's question of why she might not have contacted Asia?
Yeah, no, that was the argument Justin was making. And Theroux's response when he objected to Dante's testimony was, Gutierrez's decline is not relevant. It was already alluded to, already objected to, and already ruled on.
Yeah, but I think to Rabia's point, that's exactly right. The Tina episode that we had, we discussed a case from after 1995 where Gutierrez had failed to contact two alibi witnesses, and that seems pretty directly on point in terms of answering the question of why Asia in this case might not have been contacted.
Well, the court did allow Dante to testify and said that he would, quote, give it the limited weight that it warranted. I mean, it was a pretty limited question and answer on direct, because every time Dante tried to talk about her sickness or talk about things that were falling apart, Theroux would object and it would get sustained. Like, for instance, when Dante started talking about how Gutierrez was in great physical discomfort and bracing herself against the podium, that her questioning and her closings weren't crisp, not good. She looked ill. And at that point, Theroux objected on the grounds that it was trying to prey upon the stigma of illness.
Is that even a legal argument?
It's not an objection I've heard before.
To me, that sounds like the kind of argument you make for public appeal. And I mean, that's obviously, if you're going to make these kinds of objections, you have to have some kind of basis in the law, right?
Well, it goes to prejudice. He's trying to say that it's more prejudicial than probative because he's trying to overwhelm the court's judgment of how the quality of her performance really was by painting her as sick and therefore incompetent. So he's saying he's trying to use a stigma of sickness to imply everything she did was incompetent.
And I think that might make some sense if they were simply using MS or diabetes and saying, well, because of that condition, she might have been ineffective or made errors. But clearly in this case, we know she was disbarred. She had a record number of complaints. She had almost $300,000 from the client protection fund against her. So it's not that these are just out there and you're making deductions based on that. These are tied to very real problems she had in representation.
So what points do you think, Susan, that Dante was able to make effectively? Do you think he was a valuable witness for Adnan?
Well, he was very valuable to talking about Gutierrez and how she had started off as a great attorney. But then as time went on, Dante saw it because he referred cases to her, would try to follow up. He said back at the beginning, she was zealous, worked her butt off, could tell a story the way it should be told, and that you'd sometimes get a feeling that she was in the jury box with the jury because she connected with them so well. And that, you know, by the time it got to Merzbacher, it wasn't the same Gutierrez. And he saw these things that concerned him and that things were not the same. Trying to read my notes is kind of hard here because there was a lot of points when the judge would sustain an objection and strike the testimony. So I try to mark that by like scratching lines out. So it's kind of hard now to see which parts actually got struck in the record and which parts actually stayed in. If you go by everything he said, he did give a very interesting and close portrait of what she was like in her decline and what he saw and how things got and how bad it was. I do think only a small fraction of that is ultimately on the record based on the objections that were sustained. But I would have to wait for the transcript to know for sure.
What was his cross-examination like?
This is the one part of the hearing I was not present for. I got stuck out, probably recording for the podcast. I don't remember. But I got in just in time for the very last question of the cross-examination. I think it was very short. I don't think it was longer than 5 minutes. I was told that there was at least one exchange that went over pretty well for the defense when Thiru did question him about Gutierrez's illnesses and decline. And Thiru said, would it surprise you to learn that Gutierrez was able to engage in a 5-day intense cross-examination of the state star witness? And Dante responded, the shorter the better. As in, that's not a sign of how well she was doing if she spent 5 days cross-examining this witness.
Justin then called Bill Kanwisher, who was hired to be Christina Gutierrez's assistant in 1997 and eventually became good friends with her. He does say, though, apparently in his testimony, that he was subpoenaed to be there to testify and he did not want on his own to voluntarily come. And I can only assume that's because he had a close relationship with Gutierrez and he did not want to talk about her in any negative way in a public forum.
I think Dante was more willing to be there, but he did say at one point when Justin asked him, was it hard for you to read through these files, talking about her disbarment? And he said, it wasn't so hard then, but now, yeah, it brings up a lot of bad memories. So he was emotional too, not in an overdramatic way, but you could tell that, you know, he had cared a lot about Gutierrez. And looking back at all that happened was sad to him. Kanwisher wasn't as close with Gutierrez as Dante was, but he too had cared about her and became her friend. Although by the end, their relationship sounded pretty strained too. Kanwisher talked about how he first got to know her a little before he started to work with her. But by the time it got to the Merzbacher case, he could tell that she had a lot of physical issues and she was in pain. He testified to that, did not make it under the record because of objections that were sustained. But he told a story or started to tell a story about how during closing arguments in that case, it was before a judge that gave very strict timetables on when you could do closings. Like if you have a time for closing, you cannot go over. He held attorneys to that. So she gave her closing and the judge indicated she had 10 minutes left. And Gutierrez realized at that point she hadn't even gotten halfway through her entire closing. So she spent 10 minutes to do a rambling, frantic, ineffective closing of over half her planned material. And he said it wasn't pretty. It was a sign that she was not on the ball anymore. He also talked about how when he worked with her starting in 97, things were pretty bad. She repeatedly would hand cases over to him at the last minute. It was affecting his workload because she would say, oh, you have to help me with this. You need to take this case for me. I can't handle it. And at least twice this happened only a day or two before the actual trial. It was causing him a lot of stress just trying to deal with not only his cases, but the last minute cases that she suddenly gave up and asked him to do instead.
Was he an attorney that she was giving him for cases, or what was going on here?
He was an attorney and also an investigator, and he, I believe, did both roles well with Gutierrez. And he said that he ultimately left the firm because of Gutierrez. He said that she was hard to work with, hard to deal with. There were money issues. Quote, the general finances were extremely problematic. There were times when he just didn't get paid. She became more erratic, began to make unreasonable demands, and she was a yeller. She just didn't have control of her practice.
So I'm wondering about how the prosecution is taking this. Were objections really heavy in this portion too?
Yes.
And what was the basis of the objections generally?
The same thing was before, that it's not relevant because Gutierrez's capabilities are not before the court. Her competence is before the court, but her decline and her disbarment were not.
And Susan, I'm looking at the notes here, and maybe you can summarize this better, because it seems that Justin was asking Kanwisher a lot about the alibi notice, the fact that Asia wasn't listed, and it seems Kanwisher's saying that the fact that she's not on the alibi notice means that Gutierrez wasn't aware of her, and there would have been no reason for her to be off the list if there were any possibility whatsoever that she's an alibi witness. But it seems from your notes that Theroux objected, and a lot of those objections were sustained. Was there anything that got through and was overruled?
More of Kanwisher's testimony got in than did Dante's. But again, there was a lot that was objected to and stricken from the record, so that just not even before the court at all. For instance, at one point, when Theroux objected, Justin said, you know, I'm trying to put the court in as close a position as possible to the position that Gutierrez was at the time of trial. So this information is relevant to that extent. If you want to be in her shoes, like Theroux argues, we have to show. Justin was saying, well, if that's the case, in order to get in her shoes, you have to know what she was going through and what was going on in her life at that time.
Kanwisher worked with Gutierrez all the way up to early 1999, so that's relatively contemporaneous. And this would seem to me that there is Maryland Rule of Evidence would be 5406. It's similar to Federal Rule of Evidence 406, which is evidence of habit or routine practice. It seems, at least from the notes, that these questions about how does Gutierrez put together an alibi notice, what decisions go into who's on that list and not, what does it mean about tactical versus oversight, that would seem to be a fair game as evidence of routine practice. And it's tough to say without seeing the transcript or what happened, but it's tough to see how many of these would be sustained, and I'm not sure exactly what got through, but it seems important to me.
So more about the practice that she had in drafting alibi notices did get in. It was more anything that touched on Gutierrez's decline.
Okay.
And here's the reality of it. The judge kind of didn't have a choice because he had already ruled on this issue. At the previous PCR hearing, Justin tried to introduce evidence that Gutierrez had been disbarred and had not been, to say the least, at the top of her game. And the court declined to allow him to introduce it then. So the court's ruling in 2012 was that Gutierrez's abilities, her sickness, her decline, her disbarment were not relevant. And he continued to hold that today, which I think makes sense. If he believes and if he interprets the law to say that that is not relevant at a PCR hearing, why would that have changed from 2012 to today?
My hope is just on the same point that he doesn't give much credit to her prior reputation and performance. In other words, we sort of say she had this great reputation. She did really well up until about 95. Don't consider that if you're not going to consider evidence that she was disbarred and had these claims based upon conduct that was contemporaneous to Adnan's case.
Exactly. And that's why I was getting frustrated, because Theroux was, like I said, every chance he got, he talked about what a great fighter, what a vigorous and thorough defense attorney she was. If you're going to exclude evidence of her decline, fine. But it did feel a bit like it was hobbling defense to allow only an evidence of how great she was and exclude all evidence of how not great she was.
This is all just circumstantial, contextual evidence. I mean, the question is, what did she do with regard to Asia McLean or not? And all this that we're saying, and we're discussing these decisions by the judge, I mean, all of this should be very low down in the decision-making process of what went on here. It's helpful contextual information, but it's not something that's foremost in the mind of the judge, hopefully.
Which is a problem, an inherent problem for the defense, because, again, the judge rightfully told the parties, I want to know why she wasn't called. Well, the answer is she was falling apart. Like Justin said, the wheels were coming off the bus. There wasn't a reason other than that she just failed. And there's not really a way to show evidence of that other than pointing to the fact that she was failing all over the place during this time. Anyway, Kanwisher, I thought, was a really great witness. He was not an expert witness, but things he said about defense practice, they really resonated with me. And I really liked his approach and appreciated what he was saying to the court. I mean, he was describing how they're talking about the alibi notice, and he says, well, an alibi notice doesn't lock you into any strategy. And Gutierrez's philosophy was, as it should have been, to keep as many doors open as possible. She did anything she could to avoid being pinned down. She put as much information as you possibly could in the alibi notice to ensure that those alibis would be able to be called later, and also so that the state could not focus on the one or two she actually planned to call and would be distracted by the other names that she either probably wouldn't call or maybe even already knew she wasn't going to call, but she'd put them on the list anyway. And on cross, Theroux asked Camacher, your opinion is that Gutierrez did not make a tactical decision to not call Asia? And he responded, yes, it is my opinion that not calling Asia was not tactical. There's no evidence that that was a strategic decision on her part. Position kind of shifted at different points during the hearing. At one point, like in the beginning, they were focusing on the fact that there were 80 names listed on the alibi notice as evidence of how diligent and thorough Gutierrez was. And they said, well, look, she had 80 freaking alibis listed here. How is that not effective counsel? Look at 80 witnesses. Who wants more than 80 witnesses? Come on, she did great. It would then turn on a dime and drop that argument and say, oh, those 80 names, they mean nothing. It was just a red herring. It was just a tactic to try and waste the state's resources. So the fact that those 80 names are kind of irrelevant are people that were never contacted. Oh, no, that was all part of her strategy. So they're trying to use it both ways, which, I mean, that's for the judge to sort out. What Camacher kept pointing out, though, is that, well, this was a very long time frame for this crime. And the alibi that you need to defend this case would depend on what evidence the state had at trial. I mean, he kept emphasizing, proof will shift on cross-examination. You'll never know in advance what the state's case is going to be. So your goal as a defense attorney is to keep your options open for as long as possible. And cutting off a possible option early on makes no sense. Because again, you won't know until trial day what exactly you're going to need to defend against. So for alibis, you'd want to have as many as possible for as much of a time span as possible. And once you get to trial and find out what the alibi actually needs to address, that's when you decide which alibi to call, not before.
Right, and that's well illustrated here where it seems from all appearances that the belief was Debbie had seen Hay at 3 o'clock on January 13th, which, you know, on first impression, you look at it and say, well, then an alibi to 240 doesn't matter that much. But then when the state clearly shifts its focus and says at trial that 236 is the best buy call after the murder, well, then at that point, Asia has this greatly increased relevance. Susan, I'm looking at the notes here. I believe this is maybe the most important part, because if you go back and you look at Judge Welch's initial decision denying relief, maybe the main reason he gives for Gutierrez not being ineffective is that Asia's alibi story contradicts what Adnan told the police. And that's what Theroux tries to do on cross-examination, asking, if your client told the police that he was at school to track to mosque, then would you avoid investigating an alibi that differed from that? And I can see Justin objected and said, this is not an accurate description of the evidence. And it seems to me, at least from social media, and maybe you have a better perspective from the courtroom, that Justin did make clear there is no documentary evidence whatsoever to show that Adnan ever said he remained at the physical high school between the end of school and track, and therefore that, in fact, this is an incorrect statement. There is no contradiction. Even if you, again, assume the library is different from the school, that Adnan never said he remained at the physical school between the end of school and the start of track.
He did, not at this point, but that definitely came out later on. The judge overruled the objection, but noted he understood why it was being made. So Camacher answered, accepting Theroux's hypothetical as the truth, and he said, no, I'd investigate it anyway. People get things wrong, including clients. Witnesses change stories. So just because a client told me one thing and I found an alibi witness for something that's not exactly the same or even contradictory, that doesn't mean that it's not an alibi witness because, again, clients are people. People get things wrong. That doesn't mean it's a lie or not true. It just means they got it wrong. So you don't discard an alibi based on that. Because, again, as you said over and over, you don't know until trial what you're going to need to show. Theroux asked, well, what about a witness that's going to hurt the case? Wouldn't a defense attorney make a decision to avoid them? And Kamischer said, we don't live in a world of certitude. We don't know what will hurt or help. The only thing that matters is what comes up in court, and we don't know that in advance.
But by the end of the first trial, Gutierrez did know. And so I'm wondering if that was a point that was made in all of this, that by the end of the first trial that ended in a mistrial, Gutierrez exactly knew what the state's theory of the case was and when they are saying she was killed by. So she had an opportunity then to contact Asia.
You know, I think that's one point Justin didn't hit on, because yes, it does clearly show her in this specific case how ineffective she was. She knew. I mean, Kamischer says you never know until you get to trial here, and it's true. But in this case, because there were two trials, Gutierrez actually did know, and she still failed to do anything about it, which it's not even necessary to prove ineffectiveness, but I think it's definitely another point showing just how far gone she was. I mean, Theroux just kept trying to hit him over and over again. Doesn't an attorney have to decide at some point that an alibi witness isn't worth it? Doesn't a seasoned, experienced attorney make a decision at some point that, no, this alibi is not what I want to do, or this is not the issue here that I want to defend against? And Kamischer wouldn't give ground. He just wouldn't. He just said no. And finally, Theroux asked him, but wouldn't you agree that a defense attorney has to make a hard judgment at some point? And he said, you never know what's going to happen until the state puts its case on. As a defense attorney, we are constantly deferring judgment. It's what we do. The police mistake is tunnel vision, centering on one solution too early and fixating on that. Defense attorneys try to avoid that and keep everything as open as long as possible. Which I thought was a great line, because it pointed out just why we're here today and many reasons. The police did make a determination early on and followed that till the end. A defense attorney wants to do the exact opposite. And this is why an alibi witness for all time periods that are possibly relevant should be investigated. And then on redirect, Justin asked him, so when is the time to make a decision about an alibi? And Kamischer said, at the close of the state's case. So again, Gutierrez could make a decision not to call Asia, but that decision could only be made once the state put on its proof. And she could have seen then that yes, 236 is a critical time, and an alibi you can place Anon somewhere else, that's gold.
And then Susan, I see what I believe you transcribed as the last question and answer, where Justin asks, can you make a determination about an alibi witness without contacting them? And then the answer by Kamischer is no. That's consistent with what I've discussed in my blog, we've discussed in the podcast. There are cases out of Maryland, the Fourth Circuit, across the country, and all of them say, when your client tells you about an alibi witness, and certainly in a case like this where you have the contact information, it's very easy to pick up the phone and have someone at your firm call them. That's the obligation. It's to contact them. And you can't make a strategic decision against putting someone on an alibi notice, calling them at a trial, without first talking to them, hearing their story, understanding how they fit in, and making sense of whether this person is in fact not only helpful but necessary to your theory of the case.
The state's case, in a lot of ways, felt like a really lengthy hearing on all the reasons why, after a very detailed and careful analysis of the record and careful cross-referencing of dozens of pages from dozens of sources, an attorney might have been reasonably suspicious of Asia. But I mean, how long does it take to pick up a phone and call someone? I mean, Theroux was arguing that if she had checked these dozens of documents and cross-referenced them and seen that possibly two things here or this thing here doesn't maybe quite entirely add up, then she might be suspicious. So maybe that's why she didn't call Asia. But really, that's not the efficient use of time here, because that would have taken hours and hours as opposed to picking up the phone and calling her.
Let's say that an attorney does that. They pick up the phone, a defense attorney, and contacts a witness, and that witness turns out to be not so great for their client's case. That defense attorney does not have the duty to disclose this to the state, right? What is the argument he's making? Is that if she actually contacted Asia and realized, oh gosh, she might be hurtful to my client, what would that have meant? I mean, she could have just been like, okay, well, I'm not going to call her. That's the end of Asia, right?
Did Twitter not report on Theroux's gossipy witness theory?
I did see that.
Apparently, if you have a gossipy witness or a potential alibi witness that you think is a gossipy one, maybe it's strategic not to contact them because they'll gossip about the fact that you talked to them. But as the defense expert Irwin pointed out, well, if they're a gossipy person, they're going to gossip whether or not you talk to them. So, no. But that was the state's claim of why Gutierrez made a strategic call not to simply pick the phone up and do that, because Asia would gossip about it. And that would somehow, for undisclosed reasons, harm the defense.
The fundamental problem, as I see it, for the state is there's just no case law or precedent to back them up. And in fact, the questions they asked, such as, well, what if the alibi witness has convictions? Or what if they could hurt the case? I mean, these have all been sorted out. I mean, the Griffin case, which is from the same court as Adnan's case, one of the security guards who was robbed in the crime at issue picked the alibi witness out of a photo array. Other witnesses in that case had convictions. There's been cases where you have people who didn't cover the exact time period of the crime, and you might in fact say, well, the defendant was coming from the crime at the time. These are not reasons to avoid contacting the alibi witness. Everything that Theroux was pointing to is all the more reason why you contact the alibi witness to sort out whether they're helpful or harmful, because if they're harmful, they could become state's witnesses, and you want to figure out what they're going to say for the state if they're not going to be an alibi witness for the defense.
Well, now we move on to the alibi witness herself, Asia McLean.
When I was wandering the halls, I was joking that I was like haunting the courtroom halls. And before I headed over to Dunkin' Donuts, as I was leaving, I mean, the judge had said that, you know, basically witnesses are not supposed to talk to other witnesses, right? So I was walking down the hall towards the courtroom doors. I think I was returning from the restroom, and I just froze because I, after many, many years, 16 years, I think, saw Asia at the end of the hallway, and I recognized her immediately, and she was sitting, I think, with her husband by the court door, being just waiting to be called. And we looked at each other from very far away, smiled. I turned around and just walked away. So unfortunately, I mean, the whole time, of course, I didn't contact her or speak to her, and I still haven't. But I was deeply just kind of moved by the fact that this was the moment we had been waiting all these years for. It was emotional to see her, to be honest. Yeah.
And I guess I was the only one there, so I'm the only one who can really speak to this. But as far as credibility determinations go, I mean, she knocked it out of the park. She was just credible. And it's not like I believe that people are good at telling lies from non-lies, that they have some kind of ability to act as lie detectors. But at a certain point, it does become hard to believe that someone is simply lying about everything, because people aren't that good of actors. Not like that. And I firmly believe the judge, I'd be really shocked if the judge came back with a credibility finding about Asia that said that she was not credible on the stand, because, and it seemed like everyone else agreed too who was there, she just was credible. She seemed genuine. She seemed very nervous. But unless she is a fabulous actor, it came off as very real. So one of the big issues here is the fact findings by the judge, because this is going to go up on appeal. And on appeal, the court will consider the legal conclusions and can reevaluate them and come up with new conclusions if it disagrees with the trial court. But the factual conclusions here are binding. In most cases, the appellate court can't change the facts that the trial court finds. So if the trial court found that Asia was not credible, or that her demeanor said she was lying or something like that, well, that's his right to make that factual finding, and the appellate court would be bound by that. So there was a real risk here that if the judge did make that kind of finding, I mean, the claim's kind of dead. I am not concerned about that, because I would really be shocked. I mean, judges have shocked me plenty of times before, so who knows? But she just came off as very genuine. And I don't think anyone in that room other than Theroux thought that she was a lying liar.
Yeah, and I tracked down the case that I had mentioned before that Justin had cited, and it's a Supreme Court of New Jersey case, because a lot of people have wondered, Judge Welch in his initial opinion said Gutierrez could have looked at Asia's letters and could have figured they were an offer to lie and maybe she was lacking in credibility. And how does Asia testifying in 2016 change things? Well, the court in Porter had a very similar factual context where they were relying upon an affidavit and they decided we don't need to hear testimony by the alibi witness. That doesn't go to the first prong of Strickland, the ineffective assistance. Doesn't go to whether the counsel was ineffective and unreasonable in failing to contact the alibi witness. And here was the Supreme Court of New Jersey in response. Here the court made credibility findings without hearing Adams testify on the asserted alibi defense. Proper way to determine Adams' veracity was to assess her testimony on direct and cross-examination. Instead, the court simply speculated she would be biased. There is no substitute for placing a witness on the stand and having the testimony scrutinized by an impartial fact finder. That did not happen here. In sum, with respect to the claim of ineffective assistance of trial counsel based on the failure to investigate an alibi defense, we conclude the defendant made a prima facie showing and raised material facts in dispute. So they, in effect, remanded so that the person could testify at a reopened PCR proceeding. It's exactly what happened here. And yeah, I mean, obviously, Robbie and I weren't in the courtroom. We can't assess it. Susan, from what you're saying, what social media is saying, Asia came off as very credible. And as the Porter case makes clear, that is something that can change an initial PCR opinion denying relief based upon the judge finding that someone who didn't testify might be lacking in credibility, might be biased, et cetera. And especially in this case where in the first PCR proceeding, not only did Asia not testify, but we had Kevin Urich taking the witness stand and saying she only wrote the affidavit about seeing Adnan in the library due to pressure from the family. So certainly you can understand why Judge Welch would have ruled that way before. The Porter case, the way that Asia testified, they certainly allow for Judge Welch to look at this and say, I have an entirely different view of Asia's credibility, and that would certainly bolster both prongs of the ineffective assistance claim.
So on direct, Asia started testifying, and she was very nervous. She had a nervous giggle habit, which a lot of witnesses do. I saw some people on social media like criticizing her for that, which I'm assuming they weren't people there in the room because it didn't come across as flippant or flighty, or she was nervous, you could tell. And she kind of calmed down after a bit, after she got into the rhythm of question and answer. And she started off saying, well, she got out of school at 10:40 a.m. every day because she was in a cooperative education program like Krista. And after 10:40, they were free to go usually to their work, but her schedule changed. So sometimes she went to a part-time job, sometimes she went home. And she actually produced a little blue hall pass that showed she was permitted to leave early. I didn't get the exact dates, but it was something like December 98 to May 99. And Justin asked her, can I ask, why do you still have this hall pass? And she kind of laughed and said, because I save everything. It was in my yearbook, which, you know, was handy because it did prove that during this whole period, she got out of school at 10:40 every day. And I know I've seen this like a year ago now, feels like even longer, people saying that she said to Sarah Koenig, oh, I was mad at my boyfriend because I was waiting at the library forever for him at 2:30, 2:40. And people were like, well, school got out at 2:15. How was she waiting forever? Well, this is why. She was out at 10:40 and she went to the library and she was there for a long time because her boyfriend was supposed to pick her up at the library during his lunch break. He went to a different school nearby, but he didn't show up. And then Justin asked her, would you say that Woodlawn Public Library was part of the school campus? And Asia said, oh yeah. As in like someone asking you, was your high school in the city where you lived? Oh yeah, that kind of confidence. Like there's no debate about it, which shouldn't even be debated at all at this point because Thiru also went to Woodlawn and would know for a fact that's the case. So I find it very disingenuous that he has ever made this an issue at this point in the PCR proceeding. Anyway, though, she talked about how Derek didn't show up at lunch like he was supposed to. Justin asked her how she felt about it, and she said not too happy. She could tell it was past 2:15 and the school had been let out because the buses were in the circle. And she had no idea how she was getting home because, well, her boyfriend's not there. And if she didn't get in the bus, how would she get home if her boyfriend never showed up? And she was waiting and she saw Adnan walk into the library. And she said that she was so glad to see someone she knew because she'd been waiting there all day by herself. So she flagged him down. It was like, yay, someone I can talk to, someone I know. And he came and sat down at the library table with her and they talked. And according to her, he seemed completely normal. They talked about 15, 20 minutes. And then suddenly her boyfriend, Derek, and his friend Gerard showed up. She said, my ride's here. Everyone said hi. Then I left. And she said she remembered that Derek, like she said in Serial, was kind of like, her, was that guy hitting on you? And they had a conversation about it. And she told him, don't even start with me. You're 4 hours late. He then went back with her to his house. And she thinks this was about 15, 20 minutes after Adnan showed up. So sometime around 2:30 to 2:40. And she remembered that the next 2 days, the school was closed due to the weather.
Well, Adnan also, when he spoke to Sarah Koenig, mentioned that he remembered this conversation and had been thinking that, you know, oh,
I'm going to tease Justin. And Justin Adger was a friend of Adnan's who used to date Asia. And so during this conversation, and then after he met Asia's new boyfriend, he was thinking, oh, I'm going to tease Justin about this when I see him, that, oh, yeah, I saw her new man.
And Asia just said that what struck her was his calm manner that day, and that to her, it would be kind of weird if he was that calm and normal, and then now he's in jail for murder. And she says that after Adnan's arrest, she talked to her boyfriend and her boyfriend's friend, Gerard, and she said, you guys remember that guy I was in the library with that day? And they said, yeah. And she said, well, he got arrested for murder. And according to Asia at the hearing, they did remember seeing him too at the time. Now, apparently, Jared, when Sarah Koenig talked to her, I believe he said he didn't recall this one way or another, but it's also been 17 years, and trying to remember a one-off conversation like Asia described, well, it's not surprising the slightest that he wouldn't be able to. And as we'll get into more later, this is something that the defense expert kept bringing up. You had not just Asia. You had access to two other witnesses who at that time had contemporaneous memories of this, and they could have verified what she was saying, and they were never looked into. Then Justin went through Asia's letters, line by line, and asked her to explain various things that were said in them. And I mean, it made a lot of sense. Her responses were very logical and very like, well, that's obviously what it means, and here's what I said, and here's what I was trying to convey. And after hearing all kinds of bizarre speculation on what was meant by her letters, it was interesting to hear her very no-nonsense approach to explaining all the things that the prosecution was trying to pick apart. And I could go line by line and discuss them, but it's probably better to get the transcripts.
But are there a couple of examples that you can, or at least one example you can give us of something that has not been understood and has been kind of...
Justin pointed to the second letter, the typed one, and pointed to the little images on it and asked her what that was. And she said, well, that's old school clip art. And he asked why she included that. And she said, I was 17. I don't know. I thought it was funny. I guess here's the big one. The one that gets trumped up a lot. I will try my best to help you account for some of your unwitnessed, unaccountable lost time. 2:15 to 8 p.m. January 13th. Of course, the prosecution is saying this is an offer to give a lie or to give a false alibi. And she said, well, no, I heard from your family on the first when I talked to them that you were trying to account for your day between those two times. I saw you for some of it. And maybe if you remember that, you'll remember how long you stayed in the library that day. Of course, it wasn't an offer to give an alibi for any time in that period because she was only in the library for a small portion of it. And that's the only time that she was offering to give a statement concerning.
Yeah, which makes sense because unless she's going to bring her boyfriend and a friend into this grand conspiracy, she's limited by the time that they ostensibly showed up at the library, right? So I think that makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, unless she's going to like hack into the cameras, change those, and then convince her boyfriend and his friend to commit perjury for someone they've never met. Well, of course the offer was not for any time period. It was for the time that she was in the library. And that's the thing. If this was a false alibi, why on earth would you give the names of two people who can blow your story out of the water?
So Asia also testifies about making a trip to Adnan's parents' house on the evening he was arrested. And when she heard about the arrest, she doesn't remember exactly how she heard about it, but she did remember talking to her ex-boyfriend and Adnan's friend, Justin Adger. She wasn't sure what to do, but she said she trusted his opinion and he would know what to do. And he thought it was a good idea to go to Adnan's family and talk to them about it. So he picked her up and he took her to Adnan's home. She doesn't remember where his house was, but she does remember that she was there towards the evening. She remembers there were a lot of people there inside the house, outside the house. She remembers that she had to take her shoes off, which is common in not just Muslim homes, but a lot of Eastern homes. But she told them that she didn't know if it would help Adnan's case or it would help, you know, prepare for trial, but that she did remember seeing him in the library the day that he had disappeared and that he seemed completely normal.
She wrote those two letters and then she never heard anything ever again. And she just kind of assumed that, well, whatever I had to say was no big deal. She was in college for the time of trial, and she didn't follow it. I think she may have said she didn't even know Adnan was convicted until Rabia showed up. But she hadn't followed it for sure, and she never had any reason to know that her testimony would have been important or that the time period when she saw Adnan was critical to the case. That's when, on March 23rd, Rabia knocked on her door. Well, according to Asia.
Yeah, it's interesting. You know, we have completely different memories of how this all went down. When I say we, I don't just mean me and Asia. I mean me, Asia, and my brother Saad, because Saad was absolutely with me that day. I remember that when I first learned about Asia, I was like, he told me about it, and I said, let me see these letters she sent to you. So this is right after his conviction. And he sent me the letters, and one of the letters had a phone number, and I think it was her grandparents' house. So I called the number, and I was told that she was not there because she was either on campus or away at, you know, studying. What I remember is that then at some point, again, I called on the weekend and said, you know, I'm just calling with these letters, and I was able to get a hold of her. And then I went by with my brother, because I normally wouldn't ever show up like that. But maybe, I don't know, she's remembering it differently. We're also remembering where we were. I remember I testified about this at the post-conviction a few years ago. And what I remember was that I remember her being in a car with me, and that definitely happened, because at some point we drove off to get the affidavit notarized. And I remember being at Woodlawn at the library, like either in the parking lot or driving past it. And so I just assumed that that's where we met. Asia saying we met at her house. It could be we met at, but I have like no recollection of meeting at the house, but my brother does. So I think we're like remembering different parts. I think what happened is we probably met at her house, and then, you know, we talked, and then we took her to go get this thing notarized. And this is all in the same neighborhood. And I hadn't seen the library and the school at that point. So I'm assuming that maybe we might have swung by there. So she pointed out what she was talking about and then just headed up the street to get the affidavit notarized. So, you know, there is some slight discrepancies between, you know, how she remembers that day and how I remember it. I don't think she remembered my brother being there either, but he was definitely there.
This was 16 years ago.
Yeah, it was a long time ago, and I didn't have to even kind of testify, I mean, recall the memory necessarily until the post-conviction hearing, which was like, I think, 13 years after the fact. So anyhow, so let's hear what Asia had to say about me showing up.
Yeah, she just said that you showed up and you were very nice about it. You went to her house and you asked her if this happened about the letters. She said, yeah, that's what happened. And you asked her if you'd get it notarized. And she said that she was kind of irritated because she'd been going out the door to meet her boyfriend at the time. But she said it seemed important to get it notarized. And even though she'd never gotten something notarized before, she agreed. So you guys drove together to the little check cashing place and got the notary. It's Saturday, so the only notary that was available was the place near Woodlawn High School. So you went there, got it notarized, done deal. And Saad told me during one of the breaks that he was like, yeah, that was my idea. I'm the one who knew about the check cashing place. And then there's a notary there. So he claims that was his call to tell y'all where to go. And so that was it. That was Asia's third interaction following the time she went to Anand's parents' place, the letter she wrote, and then seeing Robbie after the trial. And that was it. Fast forward to 2010, I guess. And this is the next time that it ever comes back up in her life, is when she's at home and her husband comes in the door and says, there's someone out there who was asking for you by your maiden name, Asia McLean. It's kind of weird. I think it might have something to do with that girl who got killed at your high school. So Asia sent her husband back outside, as she put it, on a fact-finding mission to figure out what was going on so she could figure out what to do. And he brought in a business card from a private investigator. And her husband told her that he was sent by Justin Brown to ask about the letters and the affidavit she'd written way back when. Later that day, the same day that she has the investigator come by her house, she goes online and finds an old Baltimore Sun article that says Kevin Yurick is the prosecutor. She then calls around to try and find Yurick and finally gets a good number. He answers and they have a conversation. Justin asked her, why did you call Yurick? And she said, I perceive the prosecutor as an unbiased source, the good guy, the white hat. She thought that that was what you should do when something like this happened. The person who would give you honest advice and would give you an accurate depiction of events and wouldn't have a dog in the fight, so to speak, would be the prosecutor. That's the government person after all, right? So that's why she called him. And she took notes. She said that she gave Kevin Yurick a little bit of background on the case and he recognized it pretty quickly. And she asked him, why would a detective show up at my house? And he told her, oh, I don't know, I'll check on the computer. But it's been about 10 years since Anand's conviction, so it's likely they're trying to get an appeal. This is their last opportunity. They won't get another chance to do it if they don't do it now. And as Asia's notes show, Yurick told her, Brown is BS. and Gutierrez was not incompetent despite health issues. The defendant's claims are complete BS. They have no case that they're trying to claim ineffective assistance, which I found interesting because it shows that Yurick was very much aware that Gutierrez did have health issues. If he voluntarily brought that up to Asia, it means he was well aware that there was a problem there at the time that he first got this call. So again, despite the fact that Firo kept objecting to all this evidence that Gutierrez was sick and ill at the time of Anand's trial and before, and that she was falling apart, the prosecutor at the time of trial has also independently confirmed through Asia's notes that yes, he could tell that Gutierrez had health issues. So this was also the first time Asia learned anything about what happened at Anand's trial. Yurick told her that Jay helped the defendant and testified against him and got a plea bargain for doing so. And according to Asia, she didn't know about any of that at the time. She had no idea that Jay Wilds had been involved in Anand's conviction or that he'd been an accessory. She also hadn't known about the cell phone records that, according to Yurick, placed the defendant in Lincoln Park at the time that Jay says they were burying the body. Yurick also informed her that during the trial, there had been a bunch of witnesses ready to give the defendant an alibi, but after seeing the cell records, they all backed down, which is interesting because Asia was calling him as an alibi witness. So here's a prosecutor on the phone saying, yeah, well, every other alibi witness backed down once they heard about the cell records. And now you've heard about the cell records. Draw your own conclusions. And she walked away from the phone call thinking that the defendant was trying to manipulate the system and that the state had all the evidence in the world to show his guilt. She felt that it would be a waste of her time to get involved in something that was obviously an attempt to manipulate the system. So she never took further action at that point. She didn't call back Justin Brown. She didn't talk to the investigator again. She felt from talking to Yurick that this was not an issue that needed her involvement or that her involvement would be of any actual importance. It was all just kind of a technicality or a plan that the defendant had, but it wasn't based on anything about justice.
Asia is very good at keeping records, it seems. That, like she said, she doesn't throw anything away, but she's also very diligent about tracking down documentation, and she did, because when she finally did realize kind of what had happened after Serial, she decided to go and track down records for the phone call she had had with Yurick. Yurick had said in an interview, I think it was the Intercept interview that he gave, that he had spoken to Asia, but it was like 5 minutes, and it was not a very significant conversation. But Asia was able to get those records from Sprint, and the phone call turned out to be actually 34 minutes long.
She saw the Yurick interview, and she was like, wait a second, that was not what happened. That was not a five-minute conversation. So she, on her own, went to Sprint, and she tried to get these records. She was convinced that it was like a longer phone call, and she wanted to show it. So that's when she created a YouTube video featuring a call she'd made to Sprint. And she made this video for her friends. I actually saw the YouTube video way back when there was only like 14 views. So it wasn't like she'd put it under her real Asia McClain name or given it to the public. But she was trying to show her friends this kind of hilarious phone call she had with a Sprint representative, where the Sprint representative actually called her a bitch. as Asia put it, a female dog. To me, that's striking because it shows that she was that confident in her memory that she independently wanted to search out for more evidence about it. That's not something someone who's lying does. And she couldn't get them because Sprint was useless. And eventually Justin got involved to help her. He helped her get the records, and those did show that this was a 34-minute phone call, not a 5-minute phone call. And then from Serial, and when she listened through the whole thing, she learned that Kevin Yurick had testified at the previous PCR hearing in 2012, that he had had a conversation with her and that she had told him that her affidavits weren't true. She'd only done them because she'd somehow been pressured by the Syed family. And she was very emotional during this part of the testimony. She wasn't crying, but she was visibly tense and upset. She just seemed appalled about what had happened. And from her words and the way she was on the stand, you could tell she was taking this seriously, and that she, I think probably more than anything, that's why she was here today, because she learned what Kevin Yurick had said about her and that it wasn't true. And she couldn't stand the thought of that staying on the record. I have in my notes that she testified that when she learned what Kevin Yurick had said, she was in shock. She was angry at herself for letting her thoughts and opinions be represented by a third party, and that she was fairly bothered by it. She said, that's when I realized that maybe my testimony was important and it placed a great weight on her heart, that she felt in order for there to be justice, both sides need to know the facts so the evidence can be evaluated. And she felt that what Yurik had done had, she was pretty clear, she actually didn't blame Yurik for her actions. She was like, it placed a weight on my heart that I had let myself walk away because of what I'd heard, and that I let someone else be there instead of me to represent my opinions. And she was bothered by the fact that Yurik had, she felt, misrepresented what she said to him, but she was also clearly upset with herself for not speaking up in 2010 and 2012. So according to her, that's when she found Justin's number and called him because, quote, I do not like it when people put words in my mouth for me. Later on, Thiru argues that this whole thing, this whole alibi, those letters, they were all part of a teenage obstruction of justice scheme where Asia was going to forge an alibi for Anand, and it was all fake, phony thing. But come on, why on earth would Asia, who had forged an alibi at 17, have responded to having a defense investigator try and find her by calling the prosecutor?
You know, beyond this, I've always been kind of stunned by this argument that there was this scheme. I mean, after Kevin Yurik, you know, gave that testimony and I was there when he made those statements under oath, and then Sarah Koenig was kind of grappling with this. Well, what did she make those, you know, statements under pressure? And I said, you know, let me ask you something. Do you think that Adnan's family or Adnan is going to pressure a witness, you know, to write these letters and then just completely drop it and decide after the conviction to follow up? What kind of rationale, even if you're going to make the argument that maybe they forced her to do it, that they would just let the entire trial go by, two trials go by, and never try to contact her, never have anybody else contact her? If his attorney didn't contact her, he certainly could have asked me to contact her, his family to contact her, if there was an elaborate scheme. I mean, what kind of thugs wait till after a conviction to then go hunt down an alibi witness? It doesn't make sense to me at all. I don't even understand how anybody can make that argument.
And if you're Asia McClain, and when you were a teenager, you did something stupid and falsified some letters to claim that a friend of a friend had an alibi for a murder when he didn't, if 10 years later, when you're married, two kids, living across the country, an investigator knocks on your door and says, hey, I want to talk about those letters you wrote, you don't call up the prosecutor. You either, I mean, maybe you want to help out still, or maybe you just hide, but you don't risk trouble for yourself by reaching out to the one person who could get you in a lot of trouble for what you did 10 years previously. You may have heard me during the PCR updates that we did, the live updates during the hearing, where I was speculating that although I thought Thiru had from his opening been going for a Asia as a liar theme, I thought after seeing her testify that he'd back down from that, and that because she was so credible and because her story was so straightforward, he would take a different tact and argue that she just had the wrong day and that her testimony, you know, was well-intentioned, but it would have been useless because she was talking about not January 13th. Well, I turned out to be wrong with that. Thiru did go with the Asia's a scheming liar approach, and that came out on cross.
So far, things seem like pretty smooth sailing, notwithstanding the prosecutor's barrage of objections. A non-star witness, who he watched with tears in his eyes, finally got to testify after 17 years. But Asia wasn't quite done yet. Her cross-examination by the Deputy Attorney General of Maryland, Thiru Vignaraja, is yet to begin. And the smooth waters are about to get a little bit choppy. Next time on Undisclosed. thanks to Ramiro Marquez for our theme music and photography, to Christy Williams for our website, and to Baluki, who designed our logo. Our production consultant is Rebecca Lavoie. She's a true crime author and hosts the podcast Crime Writers on Serial. Dennis Robinson is our producer. And you can find us online on social media on both Facebook and Twitter. Our Twitter handle is UndisclosedPod. Make sure to tweet us your comments and questions using the hashtag Undisclosed.
The Undisclosed Podcast is brought to you in part by the Adnan Syed Trust, a legal defense fund that helps to pay Adnan's legal fees and associated investigative efforts. All proceeds raised through advertising on today's episode of Undisclosed were given to the trust. To learn more about the trust and to donate to our efforts to free Adnan, please visit www.launchgood.com/freeAdnan.